forest burns along the road.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Traces of Reality Radio on tracesofreality.com. I am your host, Guillermo Jimenez. Thank you all so much for tuning in once again, downloading today's episode, today's podcast. Quick reminder, be sure and subscribe to the show for free via iTunes or RSS feed. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. All of those links are up now on tracesofreality.com. All right, now on today's show, we've got a very special edition of TOR Radio in store for you today. I can't even talk right now. I've had a case of the giggles. This is a first edition of maybe hopefully a regular, maybe semi-regular production, a supercast, if you will, featuring James Corbett of the Corbett Report, Tom Secker of Clandestime, and myself, host of Traces of Reality. So, yeah, as I was telling you guys just now, I'm not sure what we're going to call this just yet. I was thinking maybe Traces of Corbett Time or the Clandestine Reality Report, something along those lines. What do you guys think?
Keep working on it.
It is a work in progress, but yeah. Well, okay, well, what to discuss? I mean, there's a lot in the news, obviously.
Can I start?
Yeah,
because I'd like
James,
to throw something up for conversation. I don't know if you guys have seen it yet, but there's a big report at Boiling Frogs Post right now that Sibel just put out the other day about Greenwald and Omidyar and their new journalism venture and NSA PayPal connection and documents that may be being withheld on that front. I think this is a pretty big story, pretty interesting. I was wondering if you guys have seen it yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tom, what about you, man? I've been keeping up with the story and the Twitter feeds and the feud that sort of blew up the internet yesterday. Sibel Edmonds versus Glenn Greenwald in a steel cage match. I don't know. Tom, have you read the story yet?
I'd pay to see that. I've read the story. Yeah, I haven't really followed that. I'm not on Twitter, so I haven't really followed the Twitter fallout from all of this. But yeah, it's certainly a fascinating story, and it's amazing how few people seem to have really picked up on this and recognized the significance of it. But I suppose that's in many respects the tale of Boiling Frogs Post, isn't it? But I think this is massive, because we've suspected for a long time, or even known for a long time, that PayPal has some pretty sinister connections and came from a pretty sinister place. And of course, we all use PayPal. It is central to what the alternative media are doing. And so there's a big lesson in there about sort of the risk that I suppose that we're taking and the dependency that we have on a website and a service that certainly isn't politically aligned with our best interests. We can say that much. But, I mean, the complexities of this are maybe passing me by. I mean, James, what was it in particular you were kind of trying to highlight here? Because it is a big story, but it's quite a complex story.
It is quite a complex story, but I think it's extremely interesting to see the way that the audience, if we can use that term, is kind of diverging in the into the Greenwald camp versus the Edmonds camp, and people are kind of lining up on either side of the issue, which I think, I mean, it's interesting, and obviously this is the kind of, I mean, information that that will split this down the middle. And I think that this is a kind of a dividing line in the whole story, because obviously up till this point, I think there's been not so much critical emphasis on Greenwald himself as a reporter, at least on the alternative media, because obviously he's the one bringing us this information. So it's been rather uncritically accepted. And I just think it's interesting the way that this is coming out now, and the way that it's kind of putting that dividing line in the audience. And I'm interested in the conversation that's happening at Boiling Frogs itself, because before this report was put out, there was an article that Sibel did that was questioning Greenwald and his motives, and there was some people in the comments, subscribers to Boiling Frogs, who were saying they weren't convinced by this, and there's nothing here, and Sibel just seems like she's diverting attention, et cetera, et cetera. But since this report came out, those people have basically said they take it back, and they think this is suspicious too. So I think it's interesting to see what's happening now. But also, of course, very interesting, the latest development is that Bill Binney is now trying to deny some of the statements that apparently he made for this report. This is coming from someone who tweeted some story about how he emailed Binney, and Binney is now saying that Sibel Edmonds put words in her mouth. So Sibel actually just posted the verbatim transcription of what he apparently told her, and that's basically what she quoted in the article. So So Bill Binney's trying to walk back from the story now, and I think it's extremely interesting to watch this happening and wondering what's going on behind the scenes, but only wondering at this point.
And that's Peter Kofoed, I think, is how you pronounce that last name who you're talking about, James. He's the guy who tweeted that out. I don't know much about him, unfortunately. I don't know if you all do, but apparently he is a journalist who's been involved with the NSA stories. I think I saw him tweet out something about how he co-signed a paper along with other journalists calling for other whistleblowers to come forward. But yeah, other than that, I don't know much about the guy. But you're right, he did tweet out this thing claiming that he, and I mean, I have no reason to suspect he did not do this, but he says that he contacted William Binney. And that, as you said, James, that Binney said in his comment that Sabell put words in his mouth. And so that is interesting. I saw Sabell's comments on this just a little while ago, actually. The update on the post, obviously, as you mentioned, verbatim, Binney's comments. And she says that they were read back to him and he confirmed them. So is he falling to pressure from someone for perhaps Greenwald or his camp, as you said earlier? And that is interesting in and of itself, isn't it? The way this has become sort of a dividing issue, a part of that audience that you referenced earlier, is a criticism coming from them that I've seen about this perhaps being a wedge issue that perhaps we're taking our eye off the prize. But, you know, I have to say, I don't see it that way. I do think it's a legitimate concern. I have, you know, previously, I was one of those people, James, as you mentioned. I didn't comment on that post, on that thread, but I was split on the whole Greenwald thing, on the whole ODMR venture. On the one hand, you know, there was questions about, you know, his involvement with PayPal and how that plays into the, you know, the NSA surveillance dynamic. On the other hand, people who were sort of questioning Greenwald's motives solely because he's taking, you know, a check with so many zeros at the end of it. I thought that in itself was unfair, I thought, because, you know, to my mind, there's really nothing wrong with making money, even if it's a tremendous amount of money. But the fact that it is coming from this one individual who does have at least some stake in this story, a financial and personal stake in the story, that does ring some alarm bells. And frankly, the most disturbing part about this to me, as far as Greenwald's reaction to it, was how he was so dismissive. I'm not sure if you guys saw that. Tom said earlier he's not following the Twitter stuff, so I'm gonna ask you, James, if you saw Greenwald's reaction, which is basically, you're all stupid lunatics for bringing this up and it's completely unfounded, rather than addressing the issue.
And he specifically said, look at Sabell Edmund's recent stories.
Right.
And he pointed to an InfoWars story about the Boston Marathon bombing and another story about some Turkish bribery in Congress or something, as if, look, she's a crazy conspiracy theorist. So, yeah, definitely some ad hominems from Glenn there.
Yeah, for sure. So I was disappointed by. I don't know why, but I did expect better from him. I didn't think he would go that route, and he did, which is telling, I think, anyway. Tom, what say you, man?
Well, I've never really believed in Glenn. Excuse me. Never really believed in Glenn Greenwald. I've never really bought this guy because he's participating in an extremely selective and partial use of this leaked material that I don't think is credible journalism. I don't think that's how a journalist should really behave, because if this information is worthy of being published, then it's worthy of being published for everyone to use and everyone to look through and everyone to access. We saw the exact same thing with WikiLeaks. We've seen similar sorts of things happening with the general process of declassification and leaks and secret information becoming public. It always seems to happen in this relatively drib-drab fashion, which means no one can grab the whole thing together and get an overall picture of what this information actually contains and therefore what it implies about our governments, the world we're living in, so on. And So it doesn't at all surprise me to see this guy now signing major book deals and getting involved with massive media projects. Like you say, there's nothing wrong with someone taking money. There's nothing wrong with someone making money from their art and their talent. But when you're taking money from the very people that you're supposed to be reporting on, that's a huge conflict of interest, and that's a huge problem. So, I mean, what is Glenn Greenwald exactly, is kind of my question.
Is
what,
he a journalist?
Well, it's a fair question, James. I know the way that it was being asked in those media clips you used in your Fossa presentation was, you know, deeply politicized and biased, but at heart, it is a reasonable question. Is he really operating as a journalist in this case? Or at least what kind of journalist? Because making a commercial endeavor out of exposing the security state, I mean, for one thing, you wouldn't have thought he could be remotely successful at that. So it's astonishing that he's been outrageously successful at it over the last sort of few months. But also, I don't think it's really a profitable endeavor. If it becomes a profitable endeavor, then you're probably headed in the wrong direction. You're probably doing the wrong thing. I don't know. Do you disagree?
Well, let me play a bit of devil's advocate with something that you said there, because I do see at least the potential for a reason to withhold some of the information that may or may not be in these documents. And of course, we don't know what's in them, so it's really speculation. But the argument is put forward that, for example, if these documents contained the information, for, I don't know, the internet history of Tom Secker, as an example of the things that the NSA can find out about someone, I wouldn't advocate for Greenwald or anyone else to publish that information because, you know, I don't think the public has the right to know that. We have the right to know what the NSA is doing and how they're doing it, but not specifically about the information they may have on this or that person or whatever. So if that type of information is in there, I could see why there might be a legitimate reason for not publishing that. However, I take your greater point, and I do agree with you on that level. And it's deeply disturbing to me, especially as someone who has always had reservations about Greenwald and where he's coming from. But at any rate, I've always admired his ability to marshal an argument. And he's always been very good at putting together very persuasive and very evidence-based critiques of things that have been happening around the world, basically. So I've always kind of admired his work on that level, but always been suspicious of where he's coming from. And I think this really puts it over the top for me. I really think there's something much, much more disturbing going on. And I just think it's interesting the way that a lot of the audience seems to be dancing around the main issue, which of course is the Omidyar link here. And what is this relationship to this PayPal magnate happening with these NSA documents? I mean, there has to be more skepticism amongst Greenwald's public for this aspect of the story, right? Or are they going to completely just go along with Glenn on this? It seems no one's really holding his feet to the fire on this. So I, for one, am glad at least Sabella is broaching the issue.
Yeah, I am as well. And, you know, as far as Glenn being able to mount a good argument, he is a lawyer by trade, right? So I guess it's no surprise he's able to do that. And I'm with you, James, on that point. This is kind of what I meant earlier about being split on this issue. I did see a reason to not sort of dump it all WikiLeaks style. As far as the Snowden trove of documents, for the reasons you mentioned, for also strategic reasons, which he outlined in that lengthy response to the Pando Daily story. Part of it was strategically getting this information out to sort of keep the story alive, to keep it in the public consciousness, to not let it be a sort of flash in the pan, one shot, one night story. One news cycle story, and then we're done with that. We're moving on. So I see that argument. On the other side of that same token, though, I had a conversation about this recently with Mr. Doug Owen of Blacklisted News, and the point that he made, which I thought was a legitimate one, is that perhaps, you know, that also plays into the government's hands as well, the surveillance state, in a way, in that by keeping the story alive for so long and sort of, you know, beating you over the head with it, eventually the majority of the public has heard about NSA wiretapping or surveillance so much at this point that it has become normalized. And it's like, really? It's another story about the NSA? Didn't I just hear this last week? Oh, there was a slightly different twist to it. Oh, okay. And they don't really, you know, follow along with it as well as they should because of the normalization effect. So I think that is a legitimate concern as well. There's a legitimate criticisms on both sides of that. I had more to add to that, but I've lost my train of thought, so I'll throw it to Tom.
Okay. Well, I completely understand the argument that you're making, that there are reasons to hold back some of this information. But if you saw the Guardian editors, he was talking in front of the Intelligence and Security Committee recently all about this, because obviously they're questioning him about the Snowden leaks that they published in The Guardian. And he was saying that, you know, they'd gone to tremendous lengths to kind of sift through this material and try and figure out what it is they could and couldn't publish. So they do seem to have gone through that process. And we are talking about The Guardian. They're a major media organization. It's not like they're short of people to do this work. So, well, of course, there probably will be stuff in there that I wouldn't want them to release publicly. If they're sincere about making this into a big story and a long-lasting story and a story that actually brings about some kind of societal change, then why not publish as much of it as they possibly can? Because the more people you have going over this material and the more people you have writing stories on it, the bigger the story gets and the longer it lasts and the more effect, hopefully, that it has. Whereas, if you do what they've done and release it drib-drab fashion, you do get this kind of, you've talked about it before, outrage fatigue, where people are just sort of, oh, it's another story about the Snowden files. And it got the same thing happened with WikiLeaks. So it's not like we don't have a example to look back to and say, did this work before? I mean, what came out of the WikiLeaks leaking? Absolutely nothing. It changed not a damn thing. So clearly that strategy didn't work. So to see them using it again and defending it again using the same arguments, I just don't buy it because the strategy hasn't worked. So therefore, try something different.
True, but Guillermo, I did hear your conversation with Doug Owen, and congratulations on that. Another very interesting conversation, and he made the good point that what was the point that he made? Hold on, that was just in my head. I completely lost my own train of thought there.
Okay. No worries. No, it'll come back to you. But something that I was going to add to your point, though, James, that you made earlier, is that I think the main thing that is getting lost in this sort of grand shuffle is simply the connection between ODMR and PayPal and the NSA, and that is relevant. No, you know, absent anything else outside of any other sort of twist to the story, that in itself remains evident. Relevant. And I'm not sure if you guys have seen this story just yet. This was posted just a little while ago, I think. The DailyBanner.com picked up on this story. Headline is: Report PayPal owned by Greenwald partner Pierre ODR, handed over customer data to NSA, and it's highlighting something that I was about to point out, is in that Glenn Greenwald has acknowledged the fact that it's pretty much a given at this point that PayPal cooperates and has cooperated with the NSA. There's really no question about that. His denial up until this point is a very, very lawyerly, he's given a very, I think very strategic, very careful answer in that he said, not to my knowledge, is there anything about PayPal in the Snowden documents. I'm not aware of it. I haven't seen it. Not that there isn't, but I'm just simply not aware of it, is what he has said so far. But he does acknowledge the fact that obviously PayPal has cooperated with the NSA. However, when delivered with a pointed question about whether or not this presents a conflict of interest, that is something he still has not answered, which I find surprising. It's, you know, how can you not acknowledge that? Simply acknowledge the fact that he won't, again, to me, is somewhat telling.
I couldn't agree more. But perhaps we've exhausted this topic. I mean, we could talk about this for hours, but
yeah, we probably could. You're right. Did it come back to you yet, by the way?
No, I'm going to listen to the playback and think, oh, what the hell? Oh, well.
No worries. Okay, well, let's move on then. I mean, Wow. What I mean, honestly, to tell you the truth, this has been on my mind all day today, partly all day yesterday. So I have little else to sort of on the tip of my tongue or up top of my head at the moment. So I'll leave it up to you guys. Anything else you think is relevant, either, you know, as relating to the story or just completely unrelated?
Well, there was that story that I sent you that I'd be interested to hear both of your takes on about this whole Amazon drone delivery service that they announced in the wake of a not very hard-hitting BBC expose about their sort of working conditions in their warehouses and so on. And so, yeah, I'd be interested to hear what both of you two, how you responded to that.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear what you think about it, honestly, Tom, since you were the one that sent it to us.
Well, okay, fair enough. I mean, the article that I sent you, I think, was from Digital Journal, and it was making the argument that the reason why Amazon had obviously made this big PR push that's kind of absurd and unconvincing, that, you know, at some point there is going to be some kind of micro drone delivering Amazon packages to people's homes. And the article was saying that they'd engaged in this PR push as a kind of cover-up and a whitewash and a distraction from these recent exposés demonstrating that the working conditions in their warehouses, the poor sods who actually have to go around the warehouses collecting everything, that their working conditions are basically horrible, that they're expected to pick up an item sort of once every 33 seconds or something, and that they're constantly on the go for hours running around this warehouse with these little beepy guns trying to pick things up. What I thought the article missed was that this is the transhuman element of this, that they are doing that. They are distracting from these sort of reputation-damaging exposés, but they're also selling you this idea that, oh no, this mechanized, transhuman, roboticized, regimented economy, that's not a bad thing. It's a really good thing, because ultimately it will result in the ultimate consumer experience where you order something online and within an hour a drone has delivered it to your letterbox.
Interesting. From metaphorical drone to literal drone. Interesting. Yeah, no, that is an interesting part of it. And for people who are playing along at home, the article is op-ed Amazon distracts from working conditions with drone talk. And yeah, one of the quotes from one of the workers there in that story is very much along those lines. He says, "We are machines. We are robots. We plug our scanner in. We're holding it, but we might as well be plugging it into ourselves," which is a pretty telling statement along those lines, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's a quote from... the guy that went undercover for the BBC, the recent BBC Panorama show. That's one of the things he says in the show.
Interesting. Very interesting. You know, yeah, you know, and honestly, Tom, I'm glad you brought this up, because it's actually having me think of this in a different sort of way than I've thought of it previously. Because I may have talked about this on the show previously. The fact, you know, the idea that with technology, with drone technology specifically, it's almost difficult to remain Luddites, I suppose, and not see, maybe not see the benefits of it, but to try to opt out of this sort of technology or to fight against it almost seems futile, right? I mean, this stuff only moves in one direction. This is clearly going to continue. The idea of a drone in itself doesn't disturb me as much as it disturbs other people who have made drones sort of their main issue of discussion. Obviously, a drone in the hands of the state being used to target people around the world for they happen to be on a list marked for death, that is obviously very, very disturbing. But the idea of a private company using a drone for whatever reason, I think Domino's was one of the first that I remember hearing about flying out pizza delivery drones, the pizza droney, I think they were calling it. And that I didn't really find all that disturbing. I really didn't see a problem with that, a drone being used privately either by a company or, say, by even a private citizen for, you know, whatever purpose they might find for it, crop dusting or, you know, something, say you live on a farm or something like that. So, you know, but the here you just, you know, describe it, Tom, it does give me pause, at least, you know, I have to rethink this a little bit.
Well, I do hear what you're saying there. I mean, often with this technology, the technology itself and just considered by itself isn't necessarily disturbing. I mean, there's nothing inherently disturbing about having a drone vehicle. But I do see the kind of broader process of getting us accustomed to this and all of the possibilities that lie therein. I mean, once the airspace has been opened up for these drones and they're flying around everywhere, I mean, at the very least, that creates the cover for all sorts of drones that are doing things that you don't know or you don't want to have happen. And I mean, how long will it take before the Google drones are caught accidentally scooping up all the Wi-Fi data or whatever it is, whatever the scandals of the future will be, which of course accidentally on purpose. And this is just part of that general conditioning, which again, I think is the very interesting part that Tom highlights there, of getting us kind of ready for the great plugging in of the Matrix. I mean, it sounds kind of, you know, silly or ridiculous when you put it in a contextless way, but when you put it in the context of stories like this, I mean, it is all part of that step-by-step conditioning to get us ready for the conversion of humanity into this you know, drone-like class. I mean, it is very worrying to me in that respect.
And is that inevitable, you think? Or is there something to be done about this still? I mean, is that reality something that is, at this point, sort of a foregone conclusion? I mean, what do you think, Tom?
I think it's a foregone conclusion that that's the direction they're trying to pull us in. I don't think it is a foregone conclusion that that this sort of nightmare scenario is where we're going to end up. Because, like James says, technology, I'd say this is true of all technology, it is what it is. Whether it's good or bad, or whether it has good or bad consequences, depends almost entirely on the people using it and what they're using it for. There are some things, like, I don't know, white phosphorus. I can't really think of a benevolent use of white phosphorus. But you know what I mean? Most technology would fall into that category of being morally neutral. So you could, I suppose, envision a scenario where people are, I don't know, shooting down the government drones with their own private drones or something. I'm not really sure, but a more peaceful way of looking at that maybe would that we could hack the surveillance drones and just, you know, crash them or bring them down and then leave them to rust. I don't know. There's all kinds of things we could potentially end up doing to combat this, many of which are perfectly peaceful and all of which are, I think, completely within our rights to do. So, no, I don't think it's inevitable at all. The problem is like you say, the normalization. And that, you know, most people who've watched any of these exposés or read about them, about what's going on inside these supergiant Amazon warehouses, most of them, it has given them pause for thought, and they're wondering, you know, should I be doing my Christmas shopping on Amazon or not? But because they've responded with this quite clever, if, like I say, a bit absurd and unrealistic notion that within an hour of you ordering something online, there'll be a drone delivering it at your house. What they've done is remind everyone of what it is you're getting out of the Amazon system. You're getting your books and your DVDs cheaper, and you're getting them more conveniently than if you had to travel somewhere to buy them. So I think what's important to note about this particular story and similar kinds of things is that they've moved on from drones just as a government state-imposed necessity for security, fighting the terrorists, spying on the Super Bowl, whatever, through to it's a consumer convenience. It's about making your lifestyle easier and making you into a more efficient and effective consumer. And that's a different way of selling them to us. And that's something that I did think was a shift in this story and these kinds of stories compared to where we were 2-3 years ago.
Interesting, because if you look at it in that respect, then what's the end point of that technology? I mean, how much easier would it be if you could just download it directly into your brain? You know, why are they delivering these physical objects? How 20th century? Let's get with the times. Just put the brain chip in and download it.
You, You went one step further than I thought you were going to. I thought you were about to say, why not download it and print it on your 3D printer? But you just went one leap beyond that.
I went full on nuclear option there.
Yeah. Right. But that's something interesting, though, also. I mean, that's a good question. How much more convenient can this possibly be? I mean, who doesn't like convenience after all, right? That's a consumer staple. Whoever can provide the most convenience, the most comfortable experience, that is who will thrive, I suppose, in that sort of market. But that is very interesting. And I suppose that may be where we're headed. But like you, Tom, I asked that because I do think that in a way, it sometimes seems, when it comes to technology anyway, that the way it's moving along, that it almost seems inevitable. But I suppose you're right. There is something to be done about it. Hacking a drone is obviously something that's the potential already exists for that. It's funny that most of the time when we hear about a drone being hacked, it's in a story shown in a negative light. They're talking about how, you know, these devious hackers could get a hold of a drone, and this is why the technology is not yet secure. But hacking as a form of resistance, I find interesting, Tom.
Well, it's something that occurred to me, or rather, the idea was presented to me in one of the RoboCop films, where there's an Ed 209 walking the streets. I love the Ed 209. I mean, it's an absolutely terrifying machine. But
wisdom in RoboCop, yes.
Fantastic. And a kid, like, I don't know, a 10-year-old kid, hacks into the Ed 209 with a laptop and kind of slaves it and turns it into a drone for the resistance. And I'm not suggesting that's quite what we should be doing and what we should be heroinizing.
I think you just did.
But this is the point, that if they're going to use technology against us, then why don't we use technology to protect ourselves in as much as we can, in as much as the possibility is there for us to do that and we have the ability to do it? Why not?
Yeah, and after all, that is the hacktivist mantra, I think. You know, if the government is using this technology and is able to do these things, then why is it legal when they do it and illegal when I do it? Not me personally, I'm not a hacktivist, but if I had the know-how, perhaps I would be. I don't. But that, you know, that is, a legitimate sort of argument to be made. For hacking as resistance, and I guess we can sort of move on to that as a sort of broad topic. I mean, what did you guys make of the Jeremy Hammond decision, or you know, a similar case with Barrett Brown? There's so many different cases at this point, but just, I guess, generally the idea of hacktivism as resistance and the sort of crackdown that we're seeing these days as a result of it.
Well, I will confess that I wasn't following the Jeremy Hammond story very closely, so I can't talk about that in great detail. But yes, I mean, there's obviously a huge space for hacktivism that has opened up in recent years, and obviously there exists that space in the activist community for something like that. Unfortunately, I would say, of course, that is also rife for. Well, I know Tom will probably quibble with this, but false flag events of various natures.
You mean infiltration, manipulation, and all of that? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well, okay, it's a metaphor. But anyway, yes. but exactly. I mean, the anonymous idea is a powerful idea, but of course, it's also 100% open to anyone, including, of course, the intelligence community, which we would have to be ridiculously naive to believe that they're not also pretending to be anonymous.
Yeah, that was, in fact, Jeremy Hammond's downfall, was an FBI informant or a hacktivist turned FBI informant who went by the name of Sabu. So indeed, that's obviously something that can happen. And I happen to think, that the metaphor false flag is appropriate here, because the stuff that I've been looking at recently and discussing on the program, the stuff about the way the NSA has been contracting private companies like Endgame Systems and Palantir, coincidentally, that name came up again, coming all the way back around to our original topic, which was PayPal and Omidyar, who's apparently... PayPal is in some way affiliated with Palantir. I'm not totally up to speed on all the particulars, but anyway, the way that this is sort of shaping out with these companies, not just engaging in surveillance or for, you know, so-called defense, but actively engaging in cyber warfare and antagonizing, or at least the, you know, going out aggressively and into the systems of other countries and you know, trying to exploit holes in their systems. That has all the makings to me of a potential false flag. Whereas, you know, we've seen, I've said this, I don't know, probably one too many times, but I'll say it one more time. You know, the comments by people like Keith Alexander and Michael Hayden that Anonymous is the next Al-Qaeda, that these are the people we need to really be paying attention to, that, you know, this is where the next front on this war on terror is to take place. It, at least to my mind, it seems like they're really starting to paint the picture necessary to perhaps engage in some sort of devious false flag or another war based on false pretenses, whatever you want to call it. So I want to get your guys' thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, certainly cyber terrorism or whatever they want to call it is one of the emerging fields that they're now trying to shift the war on terror towards. But, okay, let me clarify. Don't join Anonymous. I'm not in any way advocating joining Anonymous because I think it's a ridiculous organization that doesn't seem to really have any founding philosophy or principles. It just seems to be hacking as a way of thumbing your nose at the establishment. And I'm not really interested in that.
Can I still wear a Guy Fawkes mask?
If you really want to, but bear in mind, if you buy one of those, some money goes to Warner Brothers. But yeah, if you really want to join Anonymous, I suppose you can join. But that's not what I'm advocating here. I'm advocating it purely as resistance and protection. I'm not saying this should be some kind of proactive political tool where we seek out websites and manage to take them down for a few hours with denial of service attacks.
Ooh, I mean, that'll show them.
You know, it's just petty nonsense. It's not going to accomplish a damn thing. Whereas, if there is actually a surveillance drone flying around above your village and you manage to hack into it and divert it somewhere else peacefully, you've accomplished a really good thing. And you've done it without, I don't know, leaving yourself that open to any kind of reprisal. I mean, I'm sure if people start to do this, they are going to label them terrorists. I'm sure in as much as people are already doing it, they're already labeling them as terrorists. But to be honest, that's just kind of inevitable and comes with the territory. If you resist the system in any overt way, you will be labeled a terrorist or something similar. So we certainly shouldn't fear that. That's not a reason not to do it.
Well, let's bring this back down to the level of kind of the average person out there, because I mean, I get emails all day, every day from people who are scared to even pass along information about these types of topics. And now we're talking people should be resisting with hacktivism and things. I mean, that might be a bit ambitious. I think people, to a large extent, really have buckled to a large extent to the fear campaign that's been out there for years now, telling people you are being watched. Everything you do is, you know, being controlled from up top, and nothing you do will have any power, and we can come for you anytime. That's really having an effect on a lot of the people, at least a lot of the people who contact me. And again, I hear it over and over. People are even afraid to talk about the information, let alone to actually do anything about it.
That's a good point.
That is a real problem, yes. Mm-hmm. And you're right, perhaps I am being a bit... You're the one who insisted on recording a podcast with me after midnight.
Can I say just one quick thing, though? I can't believe I'm going to defend Anonymous right now, but I think I will, just to play, not even devil's advocate, actually, I do think that they have done some bit of good. You know, you have a good point, though, Tom, about, you know, the sort of nonsense that does happen with just, you know, defacing websites and stuff like that. That doesn't accomplish a thing. However, with someone like Jeremy Hammond, who wasn't an Anon, and someone like Barrett Brown, who was this journalist who was sort of embedded with Anonymous, they did, you know, produce relevant, useful information. Hammond, I believe, was the one who pilfered the Stratfor emails that led to all sorts of information coming out about the relationship between the NSA and these private companies I mentioned earlier, your Endgame Systems, your Booz Allen Hamilton, Palantir, H.P. Gary. And that I think was valuable. So there are you know, there are certain people who consider themselves part of Anonymous or hacktivists who are doing you know, real work as far as attempting to at least shed light on some of the things that we don't yet know about.
This is the problem with it, because Anonymous isn't a group, and yet there's no way to talk about it without reflecting that reality. I mean, we're talking about it as if it's some sort of group, and we're trying to differentiate one part of Anonymous from another. It's not a group. I mean, it's just a word. It's just a label. It's a lack of identity. And again, that encompasses a lot of people who are doing a lot of different things for a lot of different reasons. And it would be more fruitful to talk about sort of the individual ways that's being done, like something like Hammond, rather than talking about the label of Anonymous.
Yeah, that's a good point. No, I agree with that. And also to your point, I mean, go ahead, Tom. Did you say something?
Well, all I was going to add was that with the Stratfor emails, you're right. There was some interesting stuff in there. I spent a few good days flicking through there trying to find interesting stuff. But one thing I did notice was that my email address was actually leaked as part of that leak, because I used to get Stratfor, whatever it was, weekly intelligence strategy review, something nonsense.
Damn fault then, Tom. Come on.
Well, yeah, that was. I'm not denying that. I'm just saying, because that links back to what the argument James was making earlier about what should a leak contain. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be ethical, if you're going to be an ethical hacker and an ethical leaker, then you actually have to be ethical. And while some of the people I think in who go under the label of Anonymous certainly are, I think quite a lot of them are just kind of punk kids with nothing better to do.
Now, that's a good point, though, because this is something that I was having a conversation with a friend of mine just yesterday about Greenwald, bringing it back to Greenwald again. And he mentioned that, to his mind, Greenwald sort of walking this fine line between leaker and journalist. So what is he? Is he a journalist or is he a leaker? If he's a leaker or a hacker or hacktivist or what have you, then there are no ethics when it comes to what can be leaked, what will be disclosed, and how you disclose it. If you're a journalist, on the other hand, then ethics come into play. So yeah, I guess that once we get a clear answer to that, what sort of function he really is serving, then I suppose then we'll get an answer to that question about whether or not it's ethical for him to release everything or hold on to it. I don't know, but yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in there. Uh-oh.
If only we had the sound of a car screeching tires off the
or
it crashes
or
off the road. Yeah.
Record scratching, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I have much to add to that, but it's all, I mean, it's all very interesting. The question is, you know, if a few armchair podcasters are going to really change the direction of any of this, but it is interesting to watch and observe this unfold. But I do sometimes see this unfolding in a way that ultimately bolsters the status quo, even if Hammond was, you know, doing it for the best of intentions and on all of that. I mean, still, there's the issue of the naivete falling for the FBI informants, who are clearly infesting everything to do with Anonymous and Anonymous activities. And and then there's issues of ethical leaking. I did not know Tom Secker's email address was leaked, so now everyone out there can go and spam Tom. And yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point to raise about that kind of, you know, hack.
Well, and it's I know you jokingly pointed this out, but it was my own fault for signing up for an email blast from a website like Stratfor, knowing that they could potentially be a relatively obvious target for someone to try and hack.
Yeah, so let's put it in perspective.
Is you know, not sign up for those things.
Right.
That's all I was going to say.
Right. Wait. Well, let's put that in perspective, though, because you say, yeah, they're an obvious target for hacktivism. Sure. But I mean, anytime you give your emails to any website, I mean, it can be hacked for any number of reasons. Some to do with hacktivism, some to just do with, you know, corporate espionage or spammers or whatever. And there's lots of people who want your email address. I mean, it's something to keep in mind as a general point, not just specifically in that sort of situation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And just in general, taking it back to the level of, like you say, ordinary people who are wondering whether or not they can even share information, let alone whether they should be proactively doing anything about this or can do anything about this. Well, one thing they can do is everything that they have control over. and you have control over what information you put on the internet, up to a large extent anyway. So that is one way in which all of these people can get a bit more control over their own life and not just have, in a practical sense, more control over their privacy, but also feel that they have more control over it. Because in some ways, that's the far more important thing here. Because when people feel they have no privacy, they may as well, in effect, have no privacy, because it's those sorts of people who put everything on Facebook and everything on Instagram and everything on Twitter, because they don't actually have any concept of personal privacy left anymore. So in answer, the sort of antidote, I think, to what you were raising before about what ordinary people can do and how they feel about this, that's one thing they can do to empower themselves, and is just to remind themselves that they do actually have this control and they do have this power over what information they put out there.
I just like hearing you say privacy. Sorry. It's too early in the morning for me and too late at night for you, but good point, Tom.
But Guillermo's having a great time.
I'm having a fantastic time. Yeah. No, I think that's a good point, though, honestly, though. Yeah, that's something that we hit on a little earlier also, the normalization effect and the idea that the more we hear about how we're all being surveilled, the more we think, well, it's sort of, you know, what can I do about it? It's just sort of one of those things that just happens now, and I should adjust my behavior accordingly. But you're right, though. People should keep that in mind, that they still do have that sort of ability to empower themselves and still remain or have some semblance of a private life. But yeah, that does raise other cultural, societal issues about these kids today. I tell you, you're right though. They put everything on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Privacy isn't really very important to the youngins out there. I know I've mentioned to both of you before that I used to teach a public school. I taught teenagers, 15, 16 year olds, and yeah. So I sort of saw that firsthand for a while how much they value or don't value their privacy. It's really disturbing. It really is. And not just that, but maybe I'll throw this out there and get your take on this. But something I was talking about also with that same friend of mine earlier, these video games, right? Because I used to be a gamer, I have to say. I'm not sure about you guys. I'm not sure how you guys feel about the video game industry, but I used to have an Xbox. I still do. I just haven't turned it on in about a year and a half. I do find it disturbing, though. These Call of Duty sort of games and this sort of Xbox warfare world that we live in with the drone technology we were talking about earlier, it's not so different. Manning a drone than it is in manning a drone in Xbox. So how do you guys feel about this? I mean, first of all, are you guys gamers? And second of all, how do you feel about the current state of the gaming industry and how the military is now, has been for quite some time, surely, involved in the making of these video games?
Well, let me just say, I'm not a gamer. I haven't been since the days of Super Nintendo, so I'm a bit dated here when it comes to gaming references. But I have done a couple of podcasts on this, especially specifically one talking about the military and its cooperation with the video game industry, which is disturbing on a number of levels, as you point out. But just in my own personal experience, I do have some friends here in Japan who are gamers. Surprise, surprise, in Japan. And I remember going over to one of my friends' places here, and he had an Xbox. And it was the first time I'd ever even seen an Xbox. And he was talking to it. Xbox, play the game or whatever you say, I don't know. and that scared the hell out of me. I just saw Big Brother. I saw it right there in front of me. And to him, it was just completely natural. Yeah, of course you talk to your Xbox. Why not? And I saw all the implications of that. Oh, well, this is connected to the internet and, it's listening to what you say. And I just saw everything flash before my eyes in an instant. And I think it's the type of thing that, I guess, if you're steeped in this little by little, it's just completely normalized to you. But for me, it was kind of like if someone from 1950 or whatever was suddenly transported to today and saw all the craziness of, Homeland Security and all this crap that's happening today, they would be shocked to see what's happening. In the same way, I think if you step outside of whatever, the gaming world or whatever, for a decade or two, you will be shocked to see where it's moved to. And perhaps perhaps see with a clearer eye what some of these technologies are. And as the Snowden leak and Greenwald's reporting has revealed, of course, we now do know that, yes, they are listening in on Xbox and all of these other systems that are being installed now. So I think that's an interesting part of all of this as well, because now, you know, the perfect spying device is sitting there in your home listening to you and watching you at all times, and people are paying to have that privilege. Yay. Mm.
Well, yep. To answer your question, I essentially agree with everything James just said. I used to be something of a gamer. Certainly, I wasted plenty of my adolescence playing computer games. But I have actually recorded earlier today a roundtable with Aaron of The Age of Transitions and Adam of CerebralRevolt.com that's all about computer games. And today we were looking at kind of the psychology and the sociological impact of all of this. And in the second part that we're going to do next week, it's going to be more specifically about the military-industrial intelligence connections to all of this. But yeah, there was a story just the other day saying that the NSA is spying on World of Warcraft, which is this kind of totally immersive fantasy game where you construct your own fictional character. You have your own sort of fake identity and fake person running around in this virtual world, and that they actually have agents installed within that game, which I found fascinating, because I can understand to a certain extent their general paranoia and voyeurism, making them think, oh, we've got to keep an eye on this. I mean, let's face it, they're trying to spy on absolutely everything, so there's no reason to think World of Warcraft wouldn't also be part of that. But that they're actually installing agents within the game to, what, influence people's behavior, maybe? What is it that these agents are actually trying to do is the question that's now on my mind. And yeah, just generally, I think for most people, the way that you're encouraged to surrender your privacy and embrace the digital world and digital life is through things like Facebook. But one of the things we were exploring in this conversation earlier was that perhaps Facebook is kind of a gateway drug, if you like, to things like World of Warcraft and Second Life, where you really are just playing as if you're in, not as if you're in the real world quite yet, but that's where these games are headed, that they're actually going to replicate your life in almost every way. So I think that's another dimension to all of this that again ties back in with transhumanism and with the shift of humans from being biological entities to being some kind of technological entities. And that is the, to my mind, the overarching progression and the overarching aim of, I would say, almost everything we've been talking about today.
Interesting. And so I would think when you started talking about the you know, being plugged in or plugged out of in or out of the real world, it had me thinking, because I'm sure there are gamers or people who do immerse themselves in World of Warcraft or Second Life or anything like that, or even Facebook for that matter, as you mentioned, who would consider that their real world. I suppose it's very subjective, isn't it? But we are moving it sort of, as going back to how we talked about technology moving in this direction, it does seem like we're getting closer and closer to that point where that is really indistinguishable, at least for some people, what the quote-unquote real world is. I suppose, you know, in the end, if in your subjective consciousness, what you're experiencing to you is in fact real, this is my world, my life, then I suppose that is your real world. But that does raise interesting sort of issues with that. And I guess just to offer a bit of a little anecdote about the Xbox stuff and the military involvement with the production of the video games and how that's influencing young kids, I can offer just from my own personal experience, having dealt with teenagers for several years and hearing the kind of things that they would talk about when it comes to this. I kid you not, I had several I can't even count the number of students say to me, and they were avid Call of Duty fans, you know, really, you know, intense military style video games, and they couldn't wait to do this in real life. I can't wait to join the army, they would say. I can't wait to become a sniper or a member of a SWAT team or whatever. It troubled me on two fronts, because as I said earlier, I was a gamer up until not that long ago, And I'd always sort of told myself and sort of made the argument that, no, you know, you guys are nuts. Video games doesn't affect your behavior. Video games don't have any effect on, you know, your sort of moral makeup or will affect your behavior in the end. I used to hear this all the time when growing up about games like Mortal Kombat or what have you, that this is ruining the youth of today. But maybe I'm just getting older. I am 31 now. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's because I'm out that old fogey and I see this from a different perspective. And I do see how video games very much affect their psychology and potentially their behavior. So I just wanted to throw in my two cents on that.
Well, just a couple of things there. I mean, just firstly, from my own experience, my own limited experience gaming, I remember about a decade ago playing Grand Theft Auto of all games with my brother on his computer. And after a couple of hours of playing that game and driving around the city in that game, I remember, you know, going in the car to drive, you know, wherever we were going, and I had to think about, oh, I'm not in the game. Don't hit people. Don't run people over. You know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but you really can become immersed in that environment to the point where it starts to blur the line. And so I, from that personal experience I had there, I mean, it's always been a thought in my mind that it will be very easy for games of the future, especially completely immersive virtual reality type games, to become people's reality in a very real sense, and to really make them blur the line between their online and offline identities. So I know where all of this is heading in the long run. Mm-hmm. And that's why that's one of the reasons why I'm freaked out by so much of this technology. But secondly, you guys have convinced me to put an angry video game nerd video as one of my recommended videos in this week's subscriber newsletter. So thank you for that.
Excellent. Oh, no, and to your point, Tom.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, go ahead, man.
With GTA, playing GTA for a few hours at a time and then going outside and just walking past a car and having that momentary thing of I could steal the car. And I felt that much, much more than I would normally feel it.
So, you'd normally feel it a little, but...
Well, you know, just in the way that your imagination just sort of idly plays around as you're walking down the street. But... Yeah, I know completely that feeling. And for people who've played this, you know, for hours and hours and hours, for days, weeks, months on end, or not just that game, but any number of similar games, and if that's actually what they spend most of their time, I mean, I'm thinking about young people here, most of their time outside of school is spent doing something like that. And if it's not doing something like that, then it's being on Instagram or Facebook. Then... when do they actually have the time to just, you know, sit down and have an ordinary conversation with another human being? How much of their lives do they actually spend doing that? And therefore, how much value will they ever see in doing that? And that's, in some ways, that's the thing that that bothers me the most about this, is for our generation, where games weren't so totally immersive and where we didn't have continuous broadband connections or Wi-Fi everywhere, we still have the ability to see that, to see that there are other things in the world that are valuable. But for someone who is right now, say, 16, 17, where are they getting that message from? Where are they getting that sense of, no, your world is not just confined to playing computer games and talking to people on Facebook? Where is the encouragement to them to actually embrace something better and something more and something different in their lives? That's the thing I think that most worries me, because those people in 20 years' time are going to be running everything.
Scary thought. Mm. Really, yeah. Scary thought. Yeah. And also something you mentioned earlier, Tom, that I found worthy of repeating just now. But just to go back to that point, I do think now that these games, immersive online activity, be it on Facebook or World of Warcraft or Xbox Live or what have you, does influence one's behavior. The potential exists clearly, and now you mix in the fact that we know, you know, through these latest leaks, that indeed our suspicions are confirmed, that the NSA is listening, that they have agents, as you mentioned, Tom, embedded within these environments. So you have to ask, we have to ask ourselves, I think, you know, clearly our behavior can be influenced and manipulated. Now, by who? Who are the ones, you know, driving this forward, shaping perhaps, manipulating, or just gearing towards a given direction? That's a really, I mean, I think it's a genuine concern, and something that deserves further study. And I hope that young kids, I don't know how, but we'll see the light, so to speak, both figuratively and literally, go outside for crying out loud and see some sunshine and, you know, avoid this stuff. But, oh, man, it's just so, I mean, it is so not just immersive online, but it's just a part of life these days that, I mean, I brought this up on a previous broadcast also, just the idea of Facebook and Twitter, you know, let's forget everything else just for the moment. You know, I reluctantly joined these services about a year ago because I realized, hey, if I'm going to have a podcast and have an internet presence, you kind of need an internet presence. So I signed up for a Facebook and a Twitter and all the rest of it. But I'm fully aware of the you know, the foundings of Facebook and the CIA seed money and all the rest of it. I'm not too sure about Twitter anyway. But having said that, you know, it's sort of weird double-edged sword that, you know, I don't necessarily like it. I see its benefits from time to time, but it's one of those things that you almost have to use, at least if you're, you know, doing what we're doing now. I don't know. Your thoughts on this stuff, either of you.
Well, I'm not on Twitter. I am on Facebook, but uh-huh. I only really use Facebook to post silly stories about pigeons getting arrested for spying and that kind of thing. I don't really use it for any constructive reasons. So, yeah. I don't think it's the right forum to do that. For what you're doing, I mean, you're using it so you have a page that people can like and so people can follow what you're up to and download your latest episode when they come out and all that kind of stuff. I can see that it is a useful mechanism for that. I don't see it's a useful mechanism for much beyond that. And I don't see the purpose in Twitter. As far as I'm concerned, if Twitter shut down tomorrow, the internet would be a better place.
And the world would be a better place. Yeah, well, hey, I can't really dispute that, and no one, you know, hates hates on this type of social media nonsense as much as I do. But again, I'm on there as well, and I do spread news stories on there on a daily basis. So people who are listening, please follow me at Corbett Report. Yeah, there is a point at which there is a more than just a little bit of a disconnect between the knowledge of where this is all heading and what this is all about, and then but I'm on there anyway,
right?
And you know, I face that mostly with YouTube. I mean, I hate Google and what they're doing, and I hate Google Plus and the way they've, you know, changed the YouTube format, and they make people sign up for their silly social media nonsense to even post on YouTube. And and YouTube, of course, has incredible powers of censorship, and they have their content ID system, and they have their silly copyright strike system, whereby you have to, I mean, go through a ridiculous process to try to contest anything. And if they find against you for whatever arbitrary reasons, they can revoke your account, blah, blah, blah. So, so I am, you know, I'm deeply, deeply concerned about YouTube. And I really wish that there was another way to spread the information as widely as you can on YouTube without being on YouTube. But you know, I've had my videos seen 15 million times on YouTube. I can't imagine I would have 0.1% of that on any other platform. Is it just about getting the word out to as many people as possible, or should we be concentrating on setting example by what we're doing? And and there comes a point at which I think it will have to be the latter. But how do you make that crossover? I mean, it's a huge issue. It's not one that I think I have resolved.
No, and it's something again that I sort of struggle with myself. It does cause me some cognitive dissonance from time to time. As you mentioned, YouTube is another great example, and I'm sort of I do wish that we could find a way to sort of build a competing system. I mean, if there was another platform similar to YouTube that where I could post these videos or these podcasts on, I would happily do so. Again, I don't have the technical know-how to develop a competitor to YouTube. I really wish someone would, though. I'm kind of surprised. Well, I mean, there's Vimeo and Dailymotion, things like this. But
the problem is I have seen a few of these come up in the years that I've been doing this, and I was even promoting one at one point. It was called Rational Veracity, which is a terrible name for a website, but it was a good idea. I mean, it was this idea of this kind of an alternative YouTube. And it was definitely aimed at alternative media, and there were some alternative media people who were using it, including myself. And I was quite excited about it at the time. But then, of course, it was just the issue of it was a tiny site, but obviously video streaming is a huge bandwidth thing. So there had to be some way to try to bring in revenue. So it started putting ads on the videos, and then eventually went under, as every other single one of those types of websites I've seen has done. I mean, running a video streaming website is not an easy thing to do at the best of times. And I don't know if the resources are there for an alt media version of that right now, or one that would, you know, at least be able to stick around for more than a few months. And that's in some ways even more frustrating. You upload all your videos to this website and then boop, gone.
Right. No, that is troubles. I mean, it's disturbing because, you know, I guess the moment did pass us by. I guess 2006 was the moment where you could have developed something like this and have it take off. And YouTube was there. Not to romanticize the past too much, but I remember the good old, you know, YouTube days where these copyright protections weren't in place, there were no ads, and it was great while it lasted, I suppose. But eventually someone came along, Google, and cornered the market. Facebook has cornered the sort of social media platform market along with Twitter, although they're sort of different mechanisms. But yeah, I guess it is difficult, isn't it? I suppose for anyone who would like to throw their hat in the ring and compete with these guys, I guess I don't see how they would do it, but I'm hopeful that someone will, I guess.
Well, I'm hopeful, yeah, and I will. Let's continue romanticizing the past just for a moment, because you may remember I'm thinking it was probably around 2004 when I first started watching documentaries online in a big way, and the place to go was Google Video, which was this incredibly good format. It worked really, really well. The downloader worked really, really well. It was an amazing piece of software, but of course it was Google. And then when they amalgamated with YouTube, they just basically got rid of Google Video. And so all of that work that people had put into uploading stuff on there, that's now gone to nothing. And the one website that could compete with YouTube, and in fact offered a better thing than YouTube, because you could upload long videos and you could download them much more easily and that kind of thing, they just removed, because they bought out their own competitor. And that's kind of how it seems that's how the internet works. Well, that's how the big scale companies on the internet certainly work.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we've been talking a long time. Maybe it's time to start wrapping up this conversation, although I don't know how on earth we could possibly summarize or encapsulate what we've been talking about today.
I don't either. Tom?
No pressure.
Well, as I said before, I think the fundamental thing that ties all of this stuff together is about humans valuing their own privacy, valuing their own freedom, valuing their own ability to do things, rather than either heroizing Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and getting involved in all of that mess, or by selling out and going to Amazon and having drones deliver their DVDs to their doorstep. Rather than doing any of those things, I think the most fundamental step that people have to take with regard to all of these things we've been talking about is to value themselves and value their own nature and have some bloody self-respect in the face of all of this stuff. Because if you don't have that, then you'll lose, and we'll all lose. And so I think that's, I don't know, it's late at night, but that's the most kind of fundamental thing that I think we've been driving at tonight, isn't
it? Well done, Tom, I think. No, indeed. And, I have to say, I know we're out of time, but I was when you brought up YouTube, I was really hoping that you were going to mention the Russian Police Choir singing Get Lucky by Daft Punk. I was so hoping you were going to bring that up because it's such an obvious psyop, I think. But anyway.
No, it's a fantastic piece of PR by the KGB.
No, really. I agree. No, I was obviously just joking. But no, I think there's something to that. It was well worth your time. Maybe we'll link to that because I think it's 3 minutes worth your time, I think. All right, then. So I suppose we'll bring this to a close. I hope you guys out there have enjoyed listening to this podcast. I'm not sure if we're going with it. This is a Traces of Reality production or if we're...